Okay, then there was the Crusades, right?
Wow.
That's a real thing to be proud of as Christians, yeah. You know?
Are you going to explain all of that? Because this is kind of complicated. It's like four or five.
I mean, I can talk about it's all in my book. We don't need to delineate all the Crusades. I could talk about them if you want.
Yeah.
All right, so Pope Urban II, who was the successor to Hildebrand, declared the first crusade. And why did a crusade happen? Now, first of all, let's get it straight. It was not highly civilized Europeans going to the Near East to kick the barbarians out of Jerusalem. The barbarians, if they were anything, were the Europeans, and the civilized culture was that of the Arab culture in the Middle East, because the greatest cities of learning in the world at that time were places like Baghdad, Aleppo, Cordoba, Cairo. Anyway, the factors which led to the Crusades would include the increasing power of the papacy, right there. All right. The bottom line is it got to the point where if, for example, if a pope had declared a crusade in the year 9, in the year 995 instead of 1095, I'll guarantee you nothing would have happened. So right, remember that picture right there. So the increasing power of the papacy, because it had reached the point where if the pope says to a king, you need to do this, a king would say, yes, sir. It's not as simple as that, but it was something like that. Then the economic improvement in Europe. Some people say, really, the Dark Ages, if you will, ended around 1050 AD. So the period of about 1050 to around 1250 was a period where Europe was in economically pretty good shape, actually. And it's kind of like you could say, you know, the Depression started in whatever, 29. It'd be like there was a brief kind of uptick in 35 and 36 and then went back down again. It's kind of like that. So after 1250, and as you go into 1300, a lot of chaos came in. A number of people came and attacked Europe from outside. The Mongols just totally wreaked havoc all over Europe. And also that's when the Black Plague came in the 1300s. But during the 1100s and the 1200s, Europe had a lot of economic power. All right. Next, the desire for pilgrimage. So during the Middle Ages, most Christian pilgrims didn't go to the Middle East. Does anybody know where most Christian pilgrims in Europe went to during the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries? They went to Santiago de Compostela, which is in northwest Spain. Santiago de Compostela, my wife and I have been there. It's quite a city. So basically, it's not like no Christians, in quotes, ever went on pilgrimage to the Middle East, but it was virtually impossible. All right, and so that was another reason given. Was it the real reason they went on crusade? You know, it was certainly a stated reason. And I'm going to give some credit that probably they were at least somewhat sincere there. Another reason is lay piety. In other words, the level of holiness and Christianity in Europe, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th century, was horribly deplorable. But as we head into the 1100s, the level of just piety of your average person in society was becoming pretty significant. So a lot of Europeans were trying to express their Christianity and to really actually be Christian. All right, and so the peak of this period of lay piety is in the 1100s and the first half of the 1200s. This is when all these cathedrals were built in Europe. This is when these universities were founded. This is when the Crusades happened. A lot of, because you have to understand, there were monks and there were bishops, but you know, the average spirituality of the average citizen in Western Europe was practically zero. But as we come into the High Middle Ages, in the 11th and 1200s, lay piety was on the increase. And we'll mention a bunch of things that happened so that wanting to be spiritual, wanting to be Christian, became pretty actually normal in Europe. Okay, the next reason is the doctrine of purgatory. because, like we said, purgatory may have been invented by Gregory in the late 6th century, early 7th century, but purgatory did not become a dominant doctrine until the 11th century. But by the 11th century, the average Christian was being told, look, if you want your grandmother to not go to hell, you have to do this. All right? And, you know, people, and we have lots of letters. There's a book I didn't bring with me. It's called Medieval Christianity. And rather than give a church history from the point of view of the major events, they have documents from regular people. And they have many diaries of people who basically said, you know, I beat my wife, I did this, that, and the other thing, but so I'm going to make up for that by doing these kind of indulgences. And this it sounds horribly cynical, but it wasn't completely cynical. These are people who really felt bad about some of the things they'd done, and they were told if you will go on a crusade, you'll have a release from your sin. Yeah.
Did the local churches keep some kind of ledger of like, hey, John's got X amount of sins, going to need this much?
It was between the bishop or the priest and the individuals.
Okay.
Now, the idea of confession, that came in the 11th century. It really became huge in the 12th century. So the whole idea of going and confessing to a priest, that did not happen in 800 AD, in 500 AD. I'm not saying nobody ever confessed to a priest, but the idea that an obligation of Christianity is to go and confess to a priest to seek penance in order to absolve for that sin, that became a way to control people in the 11th century. And it became a general thing where basically it was required. So if in order to be a member of the church, you have to seek you have to do the confessional at least once a year and do the communion, I think, at least twice a year. That was in order to be saved, you had to do those things. All right? And so the seeking penance, I would say the Crusades could not have happened unless people went on the Crusades, right?
Right.
And I would say probably seeking penance, or what they would call a summary indulgence. By the way, you think of indulgence as paying money, right? But going on a crusade was an indulgence. Catholics still teach indulgences. It's absolutely part of the official dogma of Catholicism, but that does not include paying money. They don't have paying money as an indulgence. Like going a pilgrimage, thank you, going on a pilgrimage, or, building a chapel, or these kinds of things, which might involve actual money, but, okay. On top of that, Leo XII, who I mentioned just a little while ago, had officially declared the doctrine of a just Christian war. Now, it's worth noting that for the first 1,000 years of Christianity, the idea of a just Christian war was not officially a doctrine of the church. So let's say 600 AD, 700 AD, when soldiers came back from a war, they had to essentially do penance for having been a soldier. So officially, the church did not say you do warfare in the name of God. Now, were they doing warfare in the name of God? Absolutely. But Leo the 12th said, folks, this is an official dogma of the church that warfare is not inherently sinful. Before that, officially at least, according to the church, warfare was sinful, warfare in all forms, despite all the wars that were going on. I'm just telling you, the idea of a Christian war did not exist. But Leo the 12th said, there is such a thing as a just Christian war. Now, whether that's true or not is beside the point. I'm just saying that's what they did, and you can decide if that's true or not. So what were the results of the crusades? So there's all these different crusades. The first crusade was successful in that they conquered Damascus. They conquered pretty significant territory for France, essentially. It was mainly a French and English war. Later on, there were crusades that were mainly German. And they did conquer Jerusalem. They lost Jerusalem almost immediately. Then they had other crusades, and Saladin got in there, and all this stuff. The later crusades weren't even to the Middle East because they'd already had an official peace with Saladin. So when Louis the Ninth went on a crusade, he went to Egypt. One of the crusades went to Tunisia. Another crusade, you know what they conquered? Constantinople. They basically destroyed a Christian city. That's what the crusade did, and they stopped there, and they sacked the city, and they conquered most of the Byzantine Empire. That's one of the crusades. It's really pretty bad stuff. Anyway, the results of the crusades, number one, a temporary winning of Palestine to Christian kingdoms, temporary, roughly from about 1100 to around 1250, for about 100 years. There was a very, very, very tiny enclave in Acre, I think around to 1290 or so, but basically they'd lost almost all their land by around 1200, 1250. Number two, Europe kept Cyprus. So the only permanent conquest that happened because of the Crusades that actually left any place in Christian hands was Cyprus. Yippee-skippy, all right? They took Cyprus from the Muslims. Byzantine was nearly destroyed. So the Byzantine Empire, which, remember that map? Islam, Byzantium? Basically, Byzantium was almost completely destroyed as a world power. Terrible from a Christian perspective. And basically, what the Europeans did, they sacked the city, and nearly all the valuable manuscripts, the Greek manuscripts, the art treasures from Constantinople were looted and taken to Italy, primarily to Italy. It was booty for Venice and Genoa, who basically financed the Crusades. Okay, next, virtually destruction of the Church of the East. All right, the principal result of the Crusades, in my opinion, was the near wiping out of Christianity in Muslim lands. The pogroms were massive. I mean, the level of vengeance that was taken on Christianity. Now, did the Roman Church care about that? I'd like to think they did. Did they think about the fact that, you know, if you go and attack Muslim countries, they might go after the local native Christian populations? So I'm telling you, the almost complete utter destruction of Christianity in the entire Muslim area of the world was the principal single result of the Crusades. Not a good result. Okay. Trade and cultural interaction between Europe and Arab states increased greatly. So Europe gained financially from the Crusades. It was a good deal. Even though they lost the war, they gained financially. Because of the Crusades, scholars in Europe began to study Arabic. And the things they studied in Arabic were Plato and Aristotle. All right? And when scholars in Europe began to study Greek and to actually read the Bible in Greek, it was through interaction with Muslims. All right? By the way, you know, there's Roman numerals and there's all different kinds of numerals. Which kind of numbers do we use? We use Arab numbers. Which kind of script do you use? Our writing comes from our interaction with Arabia. So many things come from interaction with the Muslims at that time. All right? And so I guess it was not all bad. Europeans began to study Arab and Greek texts. And ultimately, eventually, this terrible thing called the Crusades led to the Renaissance, led to the Reformation, and, you know, anyway, history is what it is. What would have happened if there had not been Crusades? I have no idea. But the bottom line is, when Europe began to interact with the Arab world, that brought in philosophy, it brought in history, it brought in so many scholarly things, ultimately, it led to the Reformation, okay, and to the Renaissance. Now, if you want to sound smart, you say Renaissance, but I'm not trying to sound smart, so I say Renaissance. Okay, great. Now, I want to talk a little bit about spiritual revival. Like I said, during the second half of the 11th century, through the middle of the 13th century, about 1050 to 1250, there's a huge increase so that just your average citizen is wanting to be a Christian. So how are they going to do that? By reading the Bible? No. By, most of the things we consider a way to be spiritual weren't open to them. So they formed confraternities. Do we see that? Confraternities. All right, that's in the third paragraph there. The ideal of Christianity was the apostolic life. So in this big revival, and I'm not being cynical here. I mean, there was a lot of sincerity of people trying to do God's will, and it's the best they knew. And I don't know, God's going to judge them one way or another. But the ideal was the apostolic life. The ideal is to live a life of poverty, to live a life of chastity, you know, basically asceticism. Mm-hmm. So that the thing that was held out as really spiritual was to be sacrificial financially, and you know, so hospitals were started, many charitable organizations were started, and these confraternities were good things. I mean, they didn't have a welfare system, but a large welfare system developed through these confraternities. The confraternities did things like building chapels and rebuilding churches and supporting missionaries and supporting those who would go on crusades and getting together to pray together or to do worship together, things like that. The most important single lay group that started is the group known as the Humiliati. You can guess what Humiliati means. Basically, the people who are being humble. And this was an entirely lay sort of thing. And the Humiliati were just seeking to be pious, seeking to live as Christians. They established hospitals, fed the poor, performed spiritual disciplines like prayer or fasting or all these kinds of things. They did a lot of veneration of Mary. Maybe that may not seem so great to you. Many more activities. So this whole culture arose around being a Christian. And the culture of Europe became Christian. Now, maybe not what we would think of as Christian, but Europe, after about 500 years of officially supposedly being Christian, Europe became kind of Christian. So the average person, or many, many, many average people, were really trying to be spiritual. Okay, the Humiliati, it says Humiliati in northern Italy, devoted themselves to moral character. Many of them chose celibacy. They weren't priests, they weren't nuns, they weren't monks. They were just voluntarily celibate. They would wear very, very simple clothing, these kinds of things, all right? Now, should Rome support the idea of spirituality of the common people and forming these confraternities and forming these Humiliati, which are devoted to prayer and humility and worship and all that kind of stuff? You'd think, yeah, but you'd be wrong. They condemned the Humiliati. Why? Because they were not under the Pope. This is sad to contemplate how Rome would not support this. But the problem that happened is, therefore, these people went into sects. So basically, this led to all these Reformation movements. What could have happened if the popes had an ounce of common sense, there would have been reformations within the church. But what happened is the spirit of Reformation largely left the church, which I'll talk about next. So basically, people are trying to be Christians. The popes are saying, stop trying to be a Christian. Not really, but that's what it amounted to. People said, fine, I'm going to go be a Christian on my own. That's kind of what happened. All right? So, you would think that Rome would have supported the Humiliati, but instead they condemned them. At the Third Lateran Council in 1184, they're officially condemned. So if you are a Humiliati, you're excommunicated. Yes?
Is this the kind of start of, combination of Protestant and Catholic?
Well, the movements that came out of this rebellion against Rome, refusing lay people to really be a Christian, ultimately, you could say yes, that upsurge of spiritual desire, which found no fulfillment within the church, yes, that is what produced the Reformation, you could argue. All right, I'm going to give a fairly long list of causes of the Reformation, but that will definitely be on the list. It's not the only cause, but it's certainly one of them. The bottom line is, the church was shameful and people knew it, and they sought other ways. Sincere people said, if I want to sincerely be a Christian, I got to leave the church. That was a very common idea. So there were the Humiliati in northern Italy. There were these groups known as the Beguines. I don't know how to pronounce that. These were primarily women seeking the apostolic lifestyle. At this time, for the first time in hundreds of years, women started to find spiritual outlets for their spiritual energy. All right. By the way, there were nuns all the way back to the time of Benedict, but very, very, very few women even could be nuns or monks. By the way, just Joe Schmo on the street could not become a monk, just so you know. Only people with money. If you show up at a monastery and say, I'm going to join, they say, all right, where's your bucks? You know, what's your connection? What's your letter here? So very, very poor people did not have access to the spiritual life. All right, but these confraternities, there were female confraternities, and women began to express their spirituality. And we're going to see a number of women who had very significant, very major contributions to the spiritual life in this time. But this is, I don't have a single individual member of this group called the Beguines, but women started to gather together to express the apostolic lifestyle, to live a celibate life, to help the poor, and these kind of things. Yes?
Now, did these sects, when they were denounced, did they kind of go off and form their own monasteries, or were they...
They didn't form monasteries, no. Absolutely not. There's no way they're going to form a monastery.
More individualistic.
Yeah. We're going to... Here we go. They did these things. All right? That's not the only thing they did. So now I'm going to go back, and I'm going to talk about some of the attempts at creating real Christianity, not within the Catholic or the Orthodox Church, but from outside the Catholic or Orthodox Church. Now, all but one of these are happening during this huge uptick of a personal piety that happened in Western Europe. This one here, the first one, doesn't really belong on this list because it happened 500 years earlier. It happened in the East, not the West. But I don't know where to put the Paulician movement in this whole thing. Could I have half a cup also, now that you're up? Thank you. So I'm putting the Paulicians, which don't really belong in this list, I'm putting them here because we're discussing sort of Christian groups that worked outside of the established church. Okay. All right, so we'll talk about that. What about the Paulicians? They are named after Paul, but the question is, which Paul? Some say they were named after Paul of Samosata, who was a Docetist and was a heretic. And some people say they're called the Paulicians because their theology was like this guy Paul. Other people say they're named Paul because they're trying to reestablish the Christianity of the Apostle Paul. It doesn't really matter how they got their name. More likely, they got the name Paul because one of the very, very early, most influential leaders in these Paulicians happened to be named Paul. But who cares where they got their name? That's just, you know, there's... All right, now, these groups, this group was generated in what we'd call Turkey today, primarily in the region known as Armenia. Armenia had always been a buffer state between the Romans and the Persians. Armenia was the first Christianized country, the first officially Christian state in the world was Armenia in the 4th century. The second Christian state in the world was Georgia, which is next door to Armenia. So remember I said the Church of the East is a huge thing. And our idea that the only thing that matters is the Roman Catholic Church, that is not correct. Anyway, so these people, They were probably named after Paul the Armenian, but whatever. Now, what they decided was they wanted to seek true Christianity, and they felt like the Byzantine church wasn't offering them the opportunity to do that. So they rejected the formalism of the Byzantine church. They rejected the use of sacraments. They totally rejected the use of icons in worship. They didn't reject the idea of asceticism per se, but what they rejected is the whole monastic lifestyle. They also rejected infant baptism. They said the Bible is the only authority. Now, what's going to be a major problem with saying the Bible is the only authority for these people? What did they not have access to?
The Bible.
So, one of the problems from these early groups is they tended to drift into heretical kinds of teachings because they didn't have I'm not saying they had no access to the Bible. They did have some access to the Bible, but it was limited. All right, and so the Bible is always a nice check on false Christianity. That's kind of nice to have that. All right, and so that's a problem. They baptized adults by immersion. Of course, immersion was the only kind of baptism they had back then, so that's almost being redundant. It wasn't until like the 10th or 11th or 12th century that you even have sprinkling even going on. All right, were they heretics? Now, they were accused of adoptionism. Adoptionism is this idea that basically Jesus adopted, at Jesus' baptism, essentially God adopted, kind of took over this. So Jesus was fully human, and then God kind of came upon him and all that stuff at the baptism. This is a false theology, which I don't think is a major struggle for us here. So they're accused of being adoptionists. Whether they were or they weren't, we don't know, because nothing they wrote was recorded. They were all killed and hounded. They weren't all killed, but they were massively persecuted. We do not have major writings from these people. We know about them primarily because the Orthodox Church, who viciously persecuted them, wrote about them. But anyway, it's possible that some of them did buy into adoptionism. It's hard to say. Polemics against a group is not a good way to find information about that group, of course. But anyway, it's said that it's true. It is true that another group, the Bogomils, who ended up in Bulgaria of all places, which were another schismatic group that ended up, here's Turkey, over here is Bulgaria. The Bogomils, who were clearly historically tied because many of these Paulicians were exiled to this area that we call Bulgaria today, the Bogomils definitely were dualistic. The Bogomils really did have a kind of a Manichaean kind of idea of Christianity where the body is bad and there's sort of the good God and the bad God, this idea. So whether the Paulicians were that way or not, we can't say for sure. It's probably true that they had some sort of non-biblical dualistic thinking within their group, most likely. Okay? Sometimes the Byzantine emperors supported them. Now, are the iconoclasts likely to support or not support the Paulicians? Do the iconoclasts like icons or do they reject icons?
They reject them.
So are they going to like the Paulicians? So the Paulicians had periods of 30, 40, 50 years where they're like, we're so proud of you, but we're not going to attack you because you're our friend. You're agreeing with us that icons are bad. Notice the time frame here. This was hundreds of years that they were in place. And there was an independent Paulician church in Armenia with churches and their own bishops and things like that. They were never a massive movement, but they were a large movement of probably hundreds of thousands. Okay? All the earlier leaders were stoned to death. They were burned at the stake. Estimates are as many as 100,000 of the Paulicians were massacred over the years and killed by the Byzantine church. The Byzantine church, although at times they kind of let them alone, at other times they had massive pogroms and crusades. They didn't call them crusades. And so these people were viciously attacked and virtually completely eliminated by the Byzantine church. Trying to be a real Christian was dangerous. Doing it as an individual on your own is one thing, but forming an actual church based on true biblical Christianity was dangerous. On the next page, later on, it said they fled to the Balkans. Really, I think it was more like they were deported to the Balkans. And there they formed this group called the Bogomils. The exact history of the Bogomils is a little bit murky. The Bogomils were not as large a group, but they were definitely heretical in their teaching. They were similar to the Cathars, which we'll get to the last on our list. Okay, got it? Now, there's these other movements. These are the important ones are the Paulicians, the Waldensians, and the Cathars. Those are the three groups you might want to at least be aware of. The other ones is kind of nice, but if you don't remember them, it probably won't really matter much of anything at all. But there are other movements in Italy. Peter of Bruges, who practiced the apostolic life. He rejected priesthood. He rejected veneration of the cross, prayer for the dead. He said the Lord's Supper is a remembrance, not a sacrifice. They burned crosses and overturned altars. They were iconoclasts, if you will. Got it? And what the irony is, when Peter was killed, they had lit this fire of all these crosses and all these idols. And one of the enemies came in and pushed him into the fire, and he died in a fire started by his own group trying to... Yeah, okay? This is nice, and there were thousands of people that joined this movement. It came, it went. Peter dies, movement dies with him. Next is Henry the Monk. This is now in France. He was similar to Peter Breeze. He said sacramentalism is bogus. He said the priesthood, the separate priesthood is not really a biblical thing. He denied original sin, infant baptism. He was arrested and put in prison, and his movement died. By the way, the Humiliati were active throughout this time, all right, in the late 11th century and well into the 12th century. Arnold of Brescia. Now, this guy's interesting because he started an actual political revolution in Rome, and he kicked the Pope out of Rome. How about that? That's kind of interesting. He started a republic. Wow. All right, so he preached and practiced the apostolic life, rejected priesthood of unrighteous priests, led a rebellion in Rome, and the Pope was kicked out of Rome. He established a republic there. They came back in, they hanged him, they burned his body, his ashes were scattered in the Tiber River. So these are attempts to bring together lay piety under a banner other than the Pope. And what happens in every case? Killed, arrested, etc. Peter Waldo was not killed. Peter Waldo formed the most successful Reformation from the time that you can say, here's Catholicism, to the Reformation. The one fairly successful attempt was that of Peter Waldo. Actually, his name was probably more like Pierre Valdez. But the Anglicization of Pierre Valdez is Peter Waldo. All right, where is he? He's in Italy in southern France. That's where he is. Northern Italy and southern France and Switzerland. They weren't in Switzerland originally, but they ended up there. And Peter Waldo was not as rebellious as the others. His reformation was more gradual, and it was a slower. Basically, he formed a group, pretty much just another Humiliati group, essentially, who were trying to promote piety and worship of God and reading scriptures, but reading writings of the church fathers. In 1173, he sold all he had. He left his wife and his family. That's not so good, but he did. And he basically put his daughters in a monastery, and he went about leading the apostolic life, which is walking around in poverty and rags, preaching. Okay? Initially, he wasn't as rebellious, like I said, especially in his theology. In fact, some popes early on actually said, now, Peter Waldo, he's one of these guys. We can actually accept him. Because he was not rebelling on the grounds of theology. He was fairly mild in his proposals for reform. All right, and so he gathered a larger following, but over time he became more and more like the Humiliati and more like Peter Breese and others. A contemporary chronicle said of the Waldensians, they deserve a life of poverty in evangelical perfection as the apostles. So this is a group of people who, whether they were Christian, and whether we say this is a Christian group, in other words, they'd repented and been baptized in the name of Christ and are disciples, that this is a group of thousands and thousands living a disciple's life, all right, and trying to be Christians. I'm not going to judge them, but I'm saying we would give the thumbs up virtually to everything they were trying to do. All right, and over time, Peter became more confident. Because this was a large following. There were areas, there were cities where the Waldensians were the majority. There were cities in northern Italy where they were the majority. And of course, eventually, guess who's threatened? The Pope is threatened, and they're going to start to defend their prerogatives. Anyway, some of the things that we know, and unlike Peter Breese and Henry the Monk, we have writings of Waldensians. The Waldensians continued right up to the time of the Reformation. Now, most of the writings from the Waldensians are from the 15th century and later. So how much they reflect what Peter was teaching in the 12th century is not completely clear. There are a few remnant writings that probably do reflect what he wrote. But those who have studied carefully have concluded this list is things probably that he taught. The Holy Scripture is the only guide to salvation. He translated the Bible into Italian and other languages. I think like something like Provence or whatever the language it was in southeastern France at that time. Provençal, I guess it was. He didn't do it himself, but he oversaw the translating of the Bible. He taught that sacraments do not confer sanctity on the person who receives them, other than baptism, of course. Catholic priests have no authority. The Pope is the chief of heresiarchs. All right, now at this point, he's in big trouble. Yeah. This is later on in his career. He lived to 1205. So by the 1190s, this is well into his movement. He's moving. There were no heretical teachings. Unlike, say, the Cathars and the Paulicians, there's no evidence at all of anything heretical. In fact, as far as I know, every single change he proposed was a move in the right direction, every single one of them. So it's pretty awesome. Yeah. Everyone has the right to preach. He believed essentially in what you could call the priesthood of all believers. That's a very advanced teaching. Of course, not really, it's just the Bible, but all right. He said purgatory is an invention of the 6th century, that's just a statement of what's true. That is a fact. Indulgences are rejected. The prescribed fasts of the Roman Church are not obligatory. Praying through the saints is rejected. The use of icons, statues, and relics is to be abolished. Wow, that's pretty good. So we have what I would say is a Christian group. All right, to the point we say, brother and sister, give me a hug. Well, I don't know, we have to say it in Italian or something like that. All right, and so in 1214, which is 9 years after he died, the Paulicians were called heretics. For what? For not being in submission to the Pope, essentially, because there was nothing. Unlike the Albigensians, who had teachings which were, they were heretical. I mean, these guys are very problematic. Very problematic. All right? And after 1214, they were brutally persecuted. Tens of thousands of them were murdered. Here's an engraving. There was one event in Toulon, which would be in southern France, where 224 Waldensians were burned at the stake simultaneously. Just line up 224 of them, put a bunch of wood and stakes, and light them on fire one at a time. Being a Christian, you know, if you're going to join a real Christian group, what do you think the counting of the cost was like for these guys? Tens of thousands murdered. Why? Because they're trying to reestablish Christianity. All right? Most of them fled into the mountains of northern Italy or well into Switzerland. And they fled there because the bottom line is the Pope had relatively little authority. The one place you could be almost anything you want was always in Switzerland. Switzerland's made out of dozens and dozens of remote valleys, many of them with different languages. So the heartland of the Reformation during this time was Switzerland. It was also during the time of the Reformation, as we'll see in February. All right? So the Waldensians survived. They absolutely survived, despite this. Now, to be a Waldensian in a major city in Italy or in southern France, not a great idea. But they escaped into Switzerland, where they survived right up to the time of the Reformation. Many of them were absorbed into Huss's and Zwingli's movement. All right. Now, by the way, even after Zwingli, there is a tiny, tiny, tiny Waldensian group even today. I don't know. I'd have to look it up. Like, I don't know, a couple few thousand somewhere in southern Switzerland. So arguably, you could say that this group even exists in modern time. How closely they are connected to Peter Waldo is maybe debatable. But, okay, great. Next is probably the single biggest attempt at forming a new group during this time, even bigger than the Waldensians, was the Cathars, the Albigenses. And they virtually ruled southern France. But this group, this is a crazy group. I mean, these people were way out there, man. I'm telling you, they're way out there. All right? Their lifestyle, if you were to look at the lives of this group, and by the way, there's even overlap, because the Waldensians were in southeast France. All right? And so there's a fair amount of back and forth between these. But the Waldensians, despite charges of heresy, were never heretical in any way. And the stupid, forgive me for calling somebody stupid, you're probably not supposed to, but the foolish popes, they should have just said, thank you so much for taking care of the pious Christians that we don't care about. I'm telling you, by the way, eventually they did. Eventually, the papacy accepted Francis of Assisi, who was the next version of this, essentially. So this guy, Urban III, he was smart. That's one smart pope. Not Urban III. What's it? I can't remember. We'll see. We'll come up to him. But anyway, they were they're called Albigensians because the original city where and the largest city where there was in the city of Albi. All right, so that's where they got the name. They're also called Cathars. That's what they call themselves. And Cathars means the pure. And these guys were classic Christian dualists, which means probably they weren't really even Christians, all right? And so they declared physical things to be evil. Their philosophy was so much in line with what we call Manichaeism, it was practically a return to Manichaeism. All right? So they had a very dubious theology, but I'm telling you, these guys' devotion to the idea of Christianity was very, very intense. I mean, this group, talk about a devoted group. I mean, this was as radical as the early Christians in terms of willing to be persecuted and murdered. I mean, these people were, wow, I mean, these people were amazing. I mean, not all of them, but I'm saying as a group, the Cathars were incredibly devoted to their somewhat misguided idea of Christianity, I would say. The Catholic Church tried to defeat them in open debate. According to what people say, according to the church historians, every single time a Catholic teacher debated one of these Cathars, they always lost. Why? Because the lives of the members of the Catholic Church were a total mess. And I'm telling you, these people are living like Christians. That's one of the frustrations, you know. Generally, when other people go up against the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons, the problem is, on average, those stinking Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons are more Christian than we are. Hopefully not than us. I hope not. By the way, one time I was sharing my faith with this lady. She said, so are you a witness? I was a baby Christian. I don't know. A witness. Sure, yeah, I'm a witness. Yeah, I'm a witness. So we're talking. She invites me into her house, and I'm sharing about the Bible. And she's there. You're not a witness. She thought I was a Jehovah's Witness. You know? Yeah. So anyway, So I'm telling you, when the church tried to say, look, we're right, those people are wrong, that did not work. I mean, almost never did that work. So every time they would have an open dialogue, the Cathars won every time. And tens of thousands flocked into this pretty whacked out group.
And why are they so whacked out?
Well, let me say a few things more about them. Okay. So, their leaders were called perfects, not prefects. Their leaders were called perfects. And their Christianity was a little bit like, you know what they claimed Pelagius said? You know what they said that Pelagius said? Well, that's what these people said, at least some of them. I mean, calling their leaders perfects, you know, wow, that's wow. That's, ooh, man. All right. By the way, they said the communion is merely a remembrance. It's not a reenactment of any kind of a sacrifice. They rejected all forms of sacramentalism. They rejected the use of crosses, icons, veneration of saints. They believed in the priesthood of all believers. All right. They became a majority in significant parts of southern France. They were the majority. All right. And so there were hundreds and hundreds of these Cathar churches and dozens of bishops. All right. They were declared heretical very soon after they formed. Whereas the time from the Waldensians being formed and declared heretic was about 40 years or so. We're talking about these guys form in whatever, 10 years, I don't know how many years it was, very, very soon after they were declared heretics. And I would say not without at least some reason for declaring them heretics. Of course, the hypocrisy of the Pope declaring them a heretic is kind of ironic, but nevertheless. So you've heard of the Inquisition. This is what the Inquisition was started for. The original purpose of the Inquisition was to wipe these people out. And when I say wipe these people out, I mean wipe them out, as in none left alive. It was a burn to the ground policy. Genocide. It was an absolute genocide. Probably worse than any of the other crusades. It was considered the crusade. If you look at the list of the whatever 10 or 11 crusades, one of those crusades is this one. Because this happened, of course, during the height of the period that we call the crusades. Okay? The entire area of Languedoc was depopulated. That's one of the provinces of Spain. This is an entire province that was essentially depopulated, as in there's no people left there. That's how bad it got. They tried to get the French army to carry about the Inquisition, and the French people said, why should we kill all these French people? And a lot of them were even converted by the Cathars. So finally, they had to call in the Dominicans. Now, Dominic, we're gonna hit it here before we're done. The two groups of these friars were the Franciscans and the Dominicans, and the Dominicans said, sure, we'll take them out, and we will oversee the killing of these people. So the soldiers were brought in from outside of France. They brought in professional soldiers from outside of France, and they brought in the spiritual leaders to take them out. And they were generally not French people, because the French king says, we're not going to kill these people. Why would I want to kill these people? Here's a quote. This is not read around your children. Arnold of Citeaux, a legate of Innocent III, who was not innocent, I'll tell you right now, all right, said to the troops who besieged the city of Béziers, kill them all, for God will know his own. The citizens of Béziers included many faithful Catholics. The soldiers followed their orders, and an estimated 20,000 were massacred in this one action. Men, women, and children. Justification for such genocides was supplied by Augustine's teaching that it is acceptable to use physical force on heretics in order to obtain their salvation. And if you remember that quote from Augustine, he said, if you kill a few true believers, what's the big deal? They're going to go to heaven. All right? In 1229, the Council of Toulouse banned the reading of Scripture altogether. In other words, if you read the Bible, you're excommunicated. All right? That's 1229. 1233, the Dominicans were put in charge. It took about 50 years to wipe these people out. 50 years. No, 40. It took about 40 years to wipe these people out. All right? Because they were powerful militarily. You know, there was hundreds of thousands of them. And they were almost impossible to convert. The way to convert them was to kill them. I'm sure there were some conversions. Anyway, in 1255, Innocent IV, who was no more innocent than Innocent III, authorized the use of the rack. So they began to have a policy of torture to obtain false confessions and to find the names of those who we also should arrest and kill. And by the way, if you confessed, they, you know, slit your throat. But if you wouldn't confess, they burned you at the stake. That was what the Inquisition did. Okay? Inquisition was a pretty tough deal. All right? But the Inquisition was begun in order to deal with these people, the Cathars. Okay? Are these guys good or bad? You know, I would say they were living the Christian lifestyle, that's for sure.
Yeah, besides them calling their ministers, besides them calling their leaders perfect, what else did they do that was wrong?
They basically taught that, you know, a real Christian would be celibate. Their commitment to asceticism was way over the top. But also, they taught a kind of dualism, that physical things are bad, kind of like the Manichaean idea. I'm sure they downplayed the humanity of Jesus. I don't know that detail there. Now, what they actually taught is hard to say, although we do have some writings. Some of the writings of the Cathars have come to us. Some of them are really not heretical at all. There was kind of a range of writings. Some of the writings of the Cathars seemed fairly similar to the Waldensians, but others, if you read that stuff, there's some quotes in my book, you go, no, that's not good theology, right? That's
yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure some of them, that would be a description of them, yes. But very, very devoted, I'm telling you. Very devoted. All right, great. Lay piety in the 12th and 13th century. This is when the veneration of Mary became just out of control. All right, the 12th and 13th century is when the idea of purgatory became out of control. And the 11th, 12th, and 13th century is when sort of veneration of Mary was out of control. All right. In fact, there were more buildings and chapels dedicated to Mary than all the other saints combined, and probably more to Mary even than to Jesus himself. I'm telling you, it became almost like Christianity was more about Mary almost than Jesus. That period was this period right here. Okay? This is when the Immaculate Conception was conceived of. Ha ha, there's the joke. So I'm pretty sure I'm telling you that I was wrong in that earlier thing in my notes. I need to go back and fix my notes. All right, in the 12th century, in case you didn't get the joke, you know, please forgive the pun. You know. All right, yeah. This is when they began to say, Hail Mary, full of grace. In other words, we're seeking forgiveness through Mary. Man. So Mary is giving them absolution of sins. Yeah.
So forgive me, huh?
Well, you have to talk to Mary about that.
Yeah. You're asking, like, 10 of them at least, right?
Yeah.
I was under the impression that the Immaculate Conception was kind of the assumption.
No.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's...
The Immaculate Conception is the idea that Mary, unlike all other humans between her and Adam, did not inherit original sin.
Okay. So it's not the fact that she was...
I used to think that they said that it meant she was born of a virgin. That's what I used to think. I didn't know what the Immaculate Conception was until probably just maybe 8 or 10 years ago.
I thought she had.
No, what it means is she was conceived but not in sin. So she was essentially sinless from birth.
So the Immaculate Conception refers to her, not Jesus.
Absolutely.
See, I always thought it referred to Jesus in the womb.
Because, you know, if... because of the whole sacramentalism idea and ex opere operato, what are you going to do with the fact that this sinner, this person steeped in sin, gave birth to Jesus? Well, so they could say, well, they could have the Immaculate Conception of Jesus, which I guess you always had that because it's true, I guess, you know. Yeah. Says, no, we have to have an Immaculate Conception of Mary. Because Mary became venerated, I'm telling you. And one of the reasons for this is important to know, is one of the reasons that Mary is venerated so much is because Jesus was a very distant. Jesus was made more abstract in the Middle Ages. Francis of Assisi turned that around. Francis of Assisi rehumanized Jesus. So after Francis of Assisi and Catholicism, the whole Sacred Heart and all that kind of thing, that's Francis of Assisi. But to the extent that the average Christian felt like a contact with God, it was primarily through Mary, not through Jesus. So that need to have one to intercede with you for God, which according to, First Timothy is Jesus, the one interceder. All right, Mary was the principal interceder during this time. All right? And so the veneration of Mary became a rather big deal. Okay. This is the period of massive building. I mean, hundreds of cathedrals. The number of cathedrals built in France and Italy and Germany and parts of England, the building projects were unbelievable. But remember, it was a period of relative wealth. I already said that, right? This was a period of relative wealth in Europe. This is not the Dark Ages. And some people call this the first Renaissance. Some people call this period the first Renaissance, which is not without some justification. The amount of building of buildings, beautiful, amazing Gothic buildings, it's ridiculous. Most of them are now museums or discotheques and stuff like that, if they weren't destroyed in some of the wars. But this was all based on the whole purgatory / indulgences / penance system. Many monastic orders began at this time. One of the important monastic orders that formed at this time was the Augustinians. Now, who started the Augustinians? Trick question. I don't even know, but it definitely was Augustine, because Augustine had been dead for about 800 years before the Augustinians formed. But this was a group of monks who were very, very ascetic. There's a whole range of how ascetic you are, and these were on the very ascetic end. They're also very intellectual, and they're also very Augustinian. All right, so they're going to be super, super strong on predestination, on the sovereignty of God, and all that kind of stuff. So they were definitely in the spirit of Augustine. They weren't Augustinian in the sense of founded by Augustine, but they were very Augustinian. And by the way, guess which kind of monk Martin Luther was? He was an Augustinian monk. Do you think that might be significant in the direction that the Reformation took? You bet it was. I'm telling you, he was Augustinian till the day he died. He may not have been an Augustinian monk, but Martin Luther was Augustinian till the day he died. That is true. All right, great. Well, not great, but it's true. This is when the Templars and Hospitallers and the Teutonic Knights formed. These are interesting monastic orders. These are monastic orders whose purpose was to go fight wars. Now, the Hospitallers were originally there to build hospitals. And they were sent to the Middle East to build hospitals. But then they started putting people in hospitals instead of building them. The idea of a religious order whose main purpose is to kill people for Christ is really something else. The Teutonic Order were with these German knights who basically took Lithuania and Livonia and all that area and much of Poland. They kind of brought Christianity to much of Northern Europe later on because they ran out of crusades in the Middle East. So they started their crusades in Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Belarus, those areas there, setting up Catholic countries in what later became actually Orthodox territory. Anyway, All right, so next thing we're going to talk about is scholasticism, and then we're going to talk about the mendicant friars, then we're going to talk about Huss and Wycliffe. But we've been going for about 55 minutes, so let's take a break. Yeah.
Get out of the desert.
Then there were Herman's hermits. They really had the right idea. You know who Herman's hermits are?
Warrior hermits.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Yeah,
that, right. No milk today. You don't know about the Herman's hermits? The first 45 record I owned was one by Herman's hermits. No milk today.